One point we have to be careful of, yani apologia. We have to be careful of trying to appease the kuffar by changing the facts of our religion. This is all too common. He's going to present to us a fact that we consider embarrassing. Okay? So we try to change the fact, we try to change it around. Well, no, that didn't really happen. Well, no, it wasn't quite like that. And I was amazed to hear, I don't want to mention names here, but probably the most famous Islamic speaker of this North America, he happened to mention in a speech, and I was listening to it, he said, recent historical evidence shows that Aisha was 18 years old when the Prophet ﷺ married her. I couldn't help but smirk. It was just amazing that after 1,400 years, right, there is research that shows that the age of Aisha was exactly the age that Americans think is permissible to marry, 18. I wonder if we were living in, 200 years ago and that age was 22, would recent historical evidence go back to 22? It's just amazing. This recent historical evidence obviously is baloney. There's no such thing. Okay, you open up Sahih Bukhari, you open up Sahih Muslim, you open up any book of Sirah, and the age of Aisha is clearly, explicitly mentioned. Okay, why is it a problem to change the facts? Firstly, it's a lie. Secondly, this is not your job. إِنَّمَا عَلَيْكَ الْبَلَاغُ وَعَلَيْنَا الْحِسَابُ. If a person is not going to accept Islam because of something the Prophet ﷺ did, it's not your job to change that. You have to realize your job is not to tick on your gun how many converts you have. This is a mistake. Your job is to preach the message. What did the Prophet ﷺ say? On the Day of Judgment, there are going to be prophets. They have zero followers. They did their job. They were successful. But nobody believed them. So on the Day of Judgment, they're still going to be a Nabi. Just because nobody believed in them doesn't lower their status. If you were to change the message, then you are being sinful in the sight of Allah, and you are going to be punished because of this. So you have to be careful. Now, I'm not saying you have to respond to every shubha. If I were, for example, in a feminist audience, and they asked me certain questions that might be considered embarrassing, I would try my best to change the topic, go out of it. You don't have to say everything at all times. But whenever you do say something, it must be the truth. Realize this. You don't have to say all the truth all the time, but you have to say the truth all the time. Okay, understand this point. So for example, with regard to Aisha's age, okay? Suppose you were to tell a new Muslim, or a person that's not a Muslim, well actually she was 18 years old when she got married. Okay, so he goes, okay, I had a problem with that, I'll accept Islam now. He accepts Islam. He starts learning about Islam. He opens up Sahih Bukhari, the most authentic book after the Quran. And he sees in black and white the age of Aisha, which is half of 18. He now has two options. Either he's going to leave his Islam because of the lie that you told him, or he's going to reject Sahih Bukhari. He's going to reject the Hadith of the Prophet. And that is even a worse chapter in many ways. So which of these two would you have the honor of giving him? By your lie that you wanted to convince him to be a Muslim. So you have to be careful, brothers and sisters. Our job is not to distort the facts in order to convert people. If a person really doesn't like this fact, tough luck. If you have to present it, you present it. But I'm saying you don't have to present it. If someone tries to bring this up, you change it back. You say, well, really, this was the cultural practice of the time. And if you look at it, then you change the topic to tawheed, to aqidah, to something which is more general nature. So like I said, you don't have to tell all the truth all the time, but you have to tell the truth all the time. Okay? The last point that we said of the examples is the fact that the Prophet ﷺ is supposed to have, a'udhu billah, been a very violent man, always attacking, always at war, taking booty, taking ghanima, this and that. Okay? Firstly, this is without a doubt an exaggerated status. It wasn't that way. For 13 years, the Prophet ﷺ bore so many trials and tribulations. The Sahaba, some of them, were literally killed to death, torn apart by horses, put a spear up their stomach, okay, drowned. Yani during that time, there was patience. For 13 years, pure da'wah. So you have to put things into a historical context. When they come out with you like this, okay, if you really have to take this route, you have to be more explicit, more detailed. Give them a book on the seerah, tell them to read it cover to cover. Or you yourself start off. It's like, well, you can't just take one incident and ignore the whole life. For 13 years, the Prophet ﷺ is calling the people, and they are the ones persecuting him, even though they have the power, and he is the weak and helpless. Anywhere else, we call that tyranny. We call it oppression. Now the Prophet ﷺ has gone to Medina, he has an Islamic state. Jihad comes down. Even when it comes down, there are rules for jihad. There are rules that are laid down. The Prophet ﷺ told Ali ibn Abi Talib, when you attack, right? When you attack camp outside their city and send a messenger to them and give them three options. The famous rules. Give them the three options. Either they accept Islam, so they become our brothers. We'll leave them alone. Or they fight with us. They become our brothers in Islam. Or they don't want to accept Islam. Fine, pay us the jizya and let us go on. Don't worry about us. Just pay us the jizya. And in return for that jizya, we will protect you. You don't need an army. All of your military resources, they can go to zero. We will protect you now. That's our job. That's what the jizya is for. But leave us alone and let us continue our way. But if you refuse both, then we will fight you to death. So these three options are there. Even when you avail yourself to the third option, there's a methodology that you follow. The Prophet ﷺ forbade the killing of women and children and old men. He forbade the killing of monks and priests that were worshipping God and had nothing to do with the battle. He forbade the cutting off of trees or the useless destruction of property. Where do these type of laws exist in any other society or culture or army? So you have to realize, these people, they take one or two facts, firstly they exaggerate the facts, secondly they ignore everything else, and thirdly they draw a ruling based on this one perverted fact, out of context. Jihad is legislated in Islam, but there are certain conditions, preconditions, methodology. The Prophet ﷺ did engage in jihad, but you look at how he did it, when he did it, why he did it, and everything is put into place. So once again, you can't just take one fact and draw conclusions based on that. Another point that we have to talk about, what is the reason and purpose of jihad? It is not to conquer other lands and territories. It is not to take ghanima and booty and slave girls. No, it is for what everyone knows. لِتَكُونَ كَلِمَةُ اللَّهِ هِيَ الْعُلْيَا To spread the message of Islam. To spread the message of Islam. The way you go about explaining this is very simple. You say, suppose, you tell your opponent, your adversary, give me one preposition or supposition. Give me this one supposition, and then we'll base our argument on that. Then we'll prove the supposition. You're following my logic? One simple statement, grant it to me for the time being, then I'll base my logic on that, then we'll go back and prove the basic supposition. Let us presume that Islam is correct. Just for argument's sake. Let us presume that the Prophet ﷺ is the Prophet of Allah. That the Quran is a revelation from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That the religion of Islam is correct. Obviously he's not going to agree to that, but you say just for the sake of argument, let's presume it's the case. Now, that implies that everything else besides Islam is incorrect. He must agree, if the supposition is correct, he must agree to that. This then implies that the Muslims must spread their religion to others, because all of them are misguided. This too is correct. Well, how are they going to spread it? Because most of mankind is caught up in their shahawat and shubuhat. They are caught up in following their desires and following their doubts. The majority of mankind, if you were to present Islam to them, they wouldn't accept it simply because it's too strict for them. They want to follow their shahawat and shubuhat. Only when it is forced upon them, at a society level, this is Islam. And that is why, notice, whenever a group of people paid jizya, eventually they dissolved. Slowly but surely. This is the general, you might find one or two exceptions, but slowly but surely, they accepted Islam one by one, they narrowed down, because they saw the beauty of Islam. When Islam was forced upon them as a society, through the medium of jihad, when they saw the Islamic state around them, one by one, family by family, they accepted it. Whereas, if you had just come to them and explained to them the beauty of Islam, it's too difficult. My family, my relatives, my society, my culture, I can't just give it all up. And how many people have we met and we know, every single one of us, non-Muslims, Americans, they'll say Islam is beautiful. But you know the reason they're not going to accept it in the end of the day is it's just too big of a change. All of my friends and relatives, my whole way of life, Christmas, Thanksgiving, I can't just give that up. It's too much for me. Suppose now, through the medium of jihad, you could change the whole society such that they would see Islam and Islam would have the upper hand. لِتَكُونَ كَلِمَةُ اللَّهِ هِيَ الْعُلْيَا Now, every incentive is there for you to accept Islam. You have no incentive to stay behind. And this is the purpose of jihad. So if this basic premise is true, that Islam is correct, then jihad is a logical consequence of that. Now you go back and you prove to your non-Muslim friend Islam is correct, and you do that through a million and one ways, like we said in the last lecture. Any aspect of Islam you look at, you can use it to prove the correctness of Islam. Depending on who you're talking to and the context of where he's coming from, you can use anything in Islam to give him da'wah. Okay? But the point is, jihad is a logical consequence of saying that Islam is correct. And the nullification of jihad is a logical consequence of perennialism. What is perennialism? Abu Aliya just explained it if you were paying attention and taking notes. The spokes of a wheel. Which is, all paths lead to the same, you know, reality. All religions are true. When you claim that all religions are true, that's when you're going to nullify jihad. When you claim that all paths lead to the same God, we all worship God but in a different way. You know, our paths might be different, but our goal is the same. This is so a very common thought amongst the uneducated and even the educated masses of the West, is that they say all of our paths lead to the same God. When you say this, that truth is relative, that there can be more than one truth, then you have nullified jihad. But when you say Islam is true and everything else is not true, jihad is a logical byproduct of that. So you have to understand the reason for jihad. It is not to force the people to convert, but it is to provide a situation, a context, an environment, a framework for them to see the beauty of Islam, and therefore they will leave their way of life and accept Islam. And this is why, like I told you, look historically speaking, hardly any of the communities that used to give jizya still live to our times, and even those that live are such a small minority. Look at Egypt. The Coptic Christians used to be the majority. Now they are such a small minority, a few percent, 2, 3, 4% of the whole population. Yes, they are still existent. But look at what happened. Slowly but surely, over the ages, centuries, they just dissolved in. Same thing with Lebanon, same thing with Syria, same thing with so many other countries. That where the people would be giving jizya, generation by generation, it would just, the beauty of Islam is so apparent, you just have to give it up. You have to give up your kufr and accept Islam. So I'm saying we have to understand, a lot of Muslims don't realize why jihad is legislated. It is not so you put the sword to the throat and tell him to become Muslim, as much as you provide the environment for him to realize and appreciate the beauty of Islam. Basically, to put it bluntly, you shove Islam down his throat so he must accept it. Because when he sees Islam as it is, he has no reason to reject it. So the point being, when you have your discussions and they bring up the concept of jihad, you have to go back. If you really want to talk about it. Me personally, I try to get out of it because most non-Muslims are not going to understand such such logic. Because they're not on the truth is one thing. They think the truth is relative. But if you really need to talk about it, you need to talk about it from the point of view that the reason that we have jihad is because Islam is correct. And it must be shown, proven to the people that Islam is correct. Okay, so I said there are three, all of the attacks of the non-Muslims can be divided into three categories: pure lies, cultural matters, and religious matters. Each one has its own way of dealing with. Pure lies, very easy, you just prove it's a lie, it has no basis, move on. Cultural matters, you stress the fact that this is not religious as much as it is culture. In the sense that this is not an attack against the personality of the Prophet ﷺ as much as it is an attack against Arabian society, and as any pure modern anthropologists will tell you, this is the modern vibe of anthropology, there is no such thing as one culture being superior to another. It's just cultures are different. We have a certain dress, they have a certain dress. We have a certain code, they have a certain code. We have a certain... Likewise, the marriage age is different in every society and culture. Every society and culture, if you go back to the past, there was a certain age in which marriage was suitable. And for the Arabian culture of that time and place, it was post-puberty. And in fact, biologically speaking, it does make sense. Post-puberty, and even I have friends, for example, from Afghanistan, they told me, it's not possible for a girl to reach 14, 15 and she's not married. And for a boy to reach 16, 17 and he's not married. It's considered that he has a physical problem if he doesn't get married. Because that's the whole point of passing puberty, is that you're qualified to get married. That's the whole point. It's the green light from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that you're now qualified. Okay, so it's logical, but the point is, even if you wish to attack it, it's not an attack on Islam as much as it is on Arabian culture of that time. The third category we said was religious matters, and the example we gave was that of jihad. Any other matter, you have to put it in its context. You have to understand it, and you have to defend it properly. And we said you have to be careful of distorting, of changing the facts, of trying to feel that Islam is inferior, that the kafir will try to make you feel embarrassed. Firstly, never feel embarrassed if it's the truth. This feeling of embarrassment in and of itself is a weakness of iman. Okay? You can feel frustration, yeah, because you cannot convince them, that's different. But you cannot feel a type of inferiority complex. This is a weakness of iman. Secondly, do not change the facts. It causes more harm than good when you change the facts to try to appease the kafir. In the long run, it's going to cause more harm. You yourself are falling into lies. You yourself are distorting the message of Allah. You yourself will be sinful. And apart from that, this is not da'wah. Like I said, I gave the example of, for example, Aisha's age. It's a common modernist thing to change it to 18. Like I said, what are you going to do when he opens up Sahih Bukhari, Sahih Muslim, Sunan Abi Dawud, Sunan Tirmidhi, yani the Seerah of Ibn Ishaq, the Seerah of Ibn Hisham, any book of history. This is muttafaq alayh. There is no difference of opinion, the age at which Aisha was married. Any book of history. So what's he going to do when he sees you're saying something and all the books are saying something else? Either he'll reject Islam, and there are cases that where a person has rejected Islam because of a false lie that was told to him by a Muslim. A Muslim tries to convince him, put that other notch on his gun, that I converted another. So he lied to him about Islam. When he found out that this was not Islam, he said, you guys lied to me, and he left. Okay, so that's the first scenario. The second scenario is that he doubts everything. Bukhari, Muslim, Abu Dawud, Tirmidhi, Seerah Ibn Hisham. What does he have left with himself? Whatever I believe Islam is, and that is another dangerous chapter. So in the long run even, from this dunya perspective even, there is no sense to lie about our religion of Islam, to distort the facts, to try to appease the non-Muslim. One last point, like I said, a lot of things might take time for the Western mentality to understand, such as, you know, number of wives, such as early marriage age. So don't dwell upon it. Don't make an issue out of it, okay? Try to change the topic. When someone comes to you, okay, say, okay, let's just delay this. I'll talk about your thing, but let me explain to you what Islam stands for. The Prophet ﷺ was not sent so that you marry more than one woman. He was not sent so that you do jihad, for the only reason. He was not sent so that you marry, you know, 9-10 year olds. What was the message of the Prophet ﷺ? I'll answer your question, tell him that. I'll answer your question, but listen me out, hear me out first. And this is the way of the Prophet ﷺ also. When one of the emissaries came to him from Quraysh and offered him the entire world, he said, whatever you want, we'll give it to you. We'll give you this. He said, have you finished? The emissary said, yes, I've finished. So the Prophet said, okay, now it's my turn. Then he started reciting to him, Hameem, Tanzeel Kitab Allah. He started reciting to him, verses of Surah Al-Ghafir, okay? And after reaching 30 ayat, this person eventually accepted Islam. This is the sunnah of the Prophet ﷺ. He didn't respond directly to those questions that they came to with him for. We will give you this, we will give you that. He just presented Islam to him. So use this sunnah. When the people come to you with their doubts, okay, be slick if you like. Try to change the topic to something which is more neutral that you can give da'wah to, and leave this topic for later on. This is a short summary of what we want to say today, inshallah. And because Asr is coming in another 10-15 minutes, we want to open the floor for questions. Bismillah ta'ala. Subhanaka Allahumma hamdika la ilaha illa astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk. In an Islamic state, can there be religious freedom? Example, having churches or temples in an Islamic country. There are laws that govern this. In general, when a Muslim army overtakes another non-Muslim country, then the churches and the synagogues of that country that have already been in existence and the worship is being done in those places, they are left to be. But in general, you cannot build new churches or synagogues. Now again, this is not a hard and fast rule that is found in the Quran and Sunnah, but the fuqaha have derived rules from the principle, from the Sahaba, specifically from Umar and Uthman and Ali, when the Muslims opened their conquest more than the Arabian Peninsula, and they laid down, like Umar ibn al-Khattab radiallahu anhu, this is what he said, okay, is that there's not going to be any more new synagogues and churches except for the old ones, and there are a lot more conditions done, but in reality, most of this goes back to the status quo of the government, Islamic government, and the power of the Muslims, and really the ulama and what they say at that time. Okay. In general, the religious freedom is only for the Christians and Jews that are already Christians and Jews. You cannot have people converting out of Islam. Obviously, that's, you know, you're a murtad there. So the concept of religious freedom as found and as understood by the West doesn't exist. Again, brothers, sisters also, understand one simple reality. Truth is not relative. Truth is one in Islam, and that is Islam. Once you understand this, a lot of what the kuffar are barking about is because they don't have a single truth. They are searching for the truth. Therefore, they'll allow every type of religion and cult and everything because they don't think there is any truth in their religion. Because we have the truth, we have the correct religion, we cannot allow for other false religions to exist. We have to understand this mindset. Truth is Islam, and Islam is the truth. Okay, if we understand this, a lot of the mentality of the kafir will be understandable to us. Wallahu a'lam. What do you think of the seerah book, Muhammad by Martin Lings? I was just reading it today and last night actually. I've read it before. In reality, the English of this book is superb and the narrative style is unparalleled, but some of the factual statements are absolutely incorrect. Of them is, yani, astaghfirullah, some very bad things in this book. The fact that the Prophet ﷺ left the picture of Isa and her mother and the idol of Ibrahim, was it or something, inside the Kaaba, he left it untouched. And he left a picture of the Virgin Mary with with Isa as a baby inside the Kaaba, supposedly still there to this day. This is really remnants of some type of Christianity that the author might have believed in. Also, he has some type of a'udhu billah, very bad, a type of love story between the Prophet ﷺ and Zainab. So really, the book, maybe 95% of it is good, but someone needs to write a brief pamphlet, which I think has been done also, exhaustive pamphlet, which details the errors of this book, so that any person, if he wants to read this book, he can immediately mark out those sections without reading them, because if you read it, it places something in your heart. There are like 3 or 4 majorly wrong things with this book. Apart from that, the English and the narrative style is very good, and in general, I say 90% of it is based on Ibn Hisham or Ibn Ishaq, so it's fine. I have heard that the jizya is less than the zakat. Is this true? Really, the jizya goes back to the Muslim ulama and the scholars. In general, it is 2.5%. Or some ulama say more, some ulama say less. In general, it's 2.5%. And there's also other taxes that are given on land and agriculture and this and that. But again, this is not something that is exactly found in the Quran and Sunnah. It goes back to the ulama of the particular place and time where this decision needs to be done. Basically about the relativity of religions is that how can we explain that Islam is the only right religion on the earth now? Really this goes more into a little bit of common sense and logic and a little bit of aqidah and sharia. From the aqidah and sharia point, it's very easy. You quote them a few ayat, you quote them a few hadith, and that's about it. Inna dina indallah al-Islam. You know, وَمَن يَبْتَغِ غَيْرَ الْإِسْلَامِ دِينًا فَلَن يُقْبَلَ مِنْ. Allah clearly says in the Quran that the only religion Allah will accept is Islam. Islam is the religion of all of the prophets. But of course, he's not a Muslim. So these ayat will just proving to him that that's the Muslim standpoint. Even from a common sense point of view though, all you have to do is tell him that you are saying all paths lead to one. Yet no major religion, I say major because there are some freako religions that say that. No major religion, Christianity, Judaism, even Buddhism and Islam, none of them say that that all paths lead to the same. Each one of them says you must follow in this particular belief and methodology. The Christians say unless you believe in Jesus Christ, you will not be saved. This is their fundamental aqidah. And even amongst themselves, the Catholics make takfir of the Protestants and the Protestants make takfir of the Catholics. The Protestants don't consider the Catholics to be Christians and vice versa. Even though there is an ecumenical movement going on to combine between the two. But in general, the average Protestant and the average Catholic, they don't consider them each other to be proper Christians. Much less Jews and Muslims. Likewise, the Jews, until you believe in Moses and follow the Torah and your mother was a Jew, you're not going to, they don't believe in Jannah, but you're not going to be successful, whatever success is to them. So you say even according to the religions, according to the religions themselves, they are exclusive. So how can they all be right? You see what I'm saying? Every religion says you must follow me to be successful. If you don't follow me, you're going to go to the fire of hell. So how can all of these religions be correct when each one of them is saying that if you follow any other religion, you're not correct? You understand that logic? Right? Each one is saying that it is mutually exclusive than the others, yet you are saying that all of them are correct, so they don't lead to one path. Secondly, you quote to them the aqidah and the sharia of every religion. How can they lead to one path? On the one hand, you worship one God alone. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. On the other hand, you must go through Jesus Christ to go to God. And then the third, like Judaism, you don't really have a concept of God. You don't even care about it. It's just following the Torah, observing the Sabbath and the dietary laws and the religious restrictions to the end of it. So how can these contradictory paths lead to one? It doesn't even make common sense. Okay, that's about it. Yeah. born again Christians find fault with all the past prophets except Jesus, what is the best strategy to battle this? In my humble opinion, the best strategy for every and any situation, for any da'wah to any person in any situation, is to go back to Tawheed. La ilaha illallah. Any da'wah. Why? Because Allah put this in our fitrah. Can you get as simple as there is one God and only He deserves to be worshipped? It's that simple. If you are able to convince him of this basic premise, the entire religion of Islam will come in there. Who created you? God. Then why don't you worship Him? Why do you worship other than God? La ilaha illallah. In my humble opinion, like I said, Islam is a big jigsaw. You prove any one point of it, then the rest will come tumbling after. But without a doubt, the crux, the essential part of Islam, the main part of Islam is Tawheed. So you should always go back to Uluhiyya and Asma'u Sifat. You should always go back to the fact that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is one. He is the only one that should be worshipped, and His names and attributes. No person that really is desiring the truth can argue with this. So everything else is a follow-up of that. Wallahu ta'ala a'lam. Wa sallallahu wa sallam ala nabiyyina Muhammad wa alihi wa sahbihi wa sallam.